Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for being here. It is a privilege having you here this evening to go through the book of Amos as we begin going through or continue going through the minor prophets. I've got four handouts for you tonight. We'll see what happens. We're going to start with the first one here, just the single page. This says Amos. It begins with an outline on the top of the book, with the book of Amos. And then we've also got the next thing we'll look at is probably going to be the one that has the timeline on the top. And it's got several pages stapled together. It's got a timeline with Egypt, Babylon, Assyria. Just kind of overlays the different kings that are ruling at the same time. I do this for you, but I also do this for myself, so I've got some kind of understanding of what's going on. And then there's also another one that's going to have just a list of the kings of Assyria. Now, the Assyrian kings have risen in power and then declined during the days of Amos, or Jeroboam II, and they're about to rise again with another western march that's going to lead to Sargon destroying Samaria that Amos is prophesying to, and then Sennacherib coming down into Lachish, into Judah, and then retreating again. So there's going to be a lull in the Syrian. Now that's kind of setting the stage for the reign of Jeroboam, and the prophecy of ministry of Amos is the Syrians have been defeated and driven back. Jeroboam has expanded the empire because the Assyrians have also had trouble. They're having trouble in the northern borders. So they're just reigning. All the trade routes are free to go for Jeroboam, and they're prospering. And Amos comes in and warns them, this is not the way it's always going to be. And then Assyria is going to regroup and come back after Israel and in Judah. Then there's one more page. It's just a bunch of cut and paste that I didn't get time to actually read through. I did read through it, but I didn't get a chance to develop notes out of it like I'd wanted to. So this is all just cut and pasted information on Samaria archaeology, which is, again, amazing. We may get that. Otherwise, I'm going to bring that up several times because there is archaeological evidence and there's a documentation of all of or a lot of these events. So there's no way that you can look at the book of Amos and question the authenticity. I mean, there always is. But there's historical references. There's the surrounding situations, inscriptions on Assyrian monuments and Assyrian monuments and documentation in battles in Judah and Israel itself, plus other histories. So here we go. We have the book of Amos that we're going to just look at very quickly. I want to do an overview of the book first. And as we look in chapter 1, verse, we're going to come back and go through this and read through it verse by verse and teach it. But I do want to look at chapter 1, verse 1. The years for his reign, or not his reign, but his prophecy, are 762 to 745, and that's an estimate. We don't know for sure. It's at least around, I always like to say, around 760 B.C. It's possible it all took place in 1 year. It's likely it took place over a 10-year period. This is probably the earliest date, and it's got to be wrapping up by 745. So if it was an extended period, it all takes place right in here. And the first chapter, first verse says, "The words of Amos, one of the shepherds of Tekoa, what he saw concerning Israel 2 years before the earthquake, when Uzziah was king of Judah," that's in the south, "and Jeroboam II, son of Joash, was king of Israel." So he's the king in the north. So those are your two kings. And we know generally what their reigns were, so we know when it takes place. And then he's going to begin with, in verse 2, stating this, he said, or Amos said, "The Lord roars from Zion and thunders from Jerusalem." That's the place that he's speaking from, understanding there that Zion is Jerusalem, Zion is Mount Moriah, Zion is the Temple Mount, where the Lord's presence is. That we saw it come down during Solomon's day. He resides there. We're going to see him leave in Ezekiel's day. So when it says the Lord roars from Zion, you don't need to think of that being in heaven. He's speaking from the temple in Jerusalem. But then, and again, thunders. Those are both attack words, roars, thunders. And as we talked about actually in church on Sunday when we were talking about a theophany, tying Ephesians chapter 4 into Psalm 68, which ties into Matthew 27 and went through that. Theophany is where God is moving in history. You're going to see things like earthquakes, darkness. You're going to have him speaking or roaring, just like on Mount Sinai. And you see that right here. So this is, in a sense, a theophany. We saw it last night when we went through Revelations chapters 8, 9, and 10, when there was silence in heaven, or right before God began to move. And we see that in these prophets, whenever there's silence, it says, let the earth be silent, or there was silence, or a hush. The next thing that happens is, and then there was an earthquake. As God begins to move, all of a sudden there's a moment of silence, and then everything breaks loose in the prophecy. That's what's taking place right here. The Lord roars from Zion and thunders from Jerusalem. The pastures of the shepherds dry up. That's indicating a drought. And the top of Carmel withers. The reason probably Carmel is mentioned is Carmel is the mountain range by the Mediterranean Sea. Even in the days of Elijah, when all there had been a 3.5-year drought, remember, you ever wondered about this, when they poured out water on the altars in Elijah's day. You know, he said, pour out water. And they built a trench and poured more water. I mean, there's been 3.5 years of drought. Everybody's going out without water. Where are they getting the water from? Well, there was still water on Mount Carmel near the Mediterranean Sea. And so Mount Carmel is like the last place to run out of water, the last place to dry up. And it is, in a sense, the far northwestern part of the Israel nation. And again, the border went further north than that. But to imagine that the Lord is roaring from Jerusalem, from the Temple Mount, and the fields wither, starting there, going all the way up to Mount Carmel, even Mount Carmel withers, it means this is devastating. And then what he's going to do is there's going to be 8 prophecies or 8 oracles that are going to be given here in chapters 1 and 2. 7 of them, well, we'll say this, 6 of them are going to be against nations, foreign nations, and then 1 is going to be against Judah, which is, in Israel's eyes, a foreign nation. Remember, Israel and Judah have separated, so this is the southern kingdom of Israel. So there's 7, and so you can imagine all the people of Israel are hearing this, and it would be agreeing with all the judgments being spoken against their enemies, but then there's going to be an 8th prolonged, extended oracle or prophecy against Israel itself. That's what we have right here. And if you look in the notes right here, point 2b, chapter 1, verse 3 through chapter 2, verse 8, there are 7 nations that are given words of judgment. All of them are neighbors of Israel. You've got Syria, Philistia, Phoenicia, Edom, Ammon, Moab. So they're going to go down the coast, go all the way around on the other side of the Dead Sea or the Jordan River. They're going to go south into Judah. And then chapter 2, verse 6, then continuing all the way up to chapter 6, verse 14, Israel is going to be addressed by Amos. And so in typical fashion, I'll just read a couple of these. When we start studying these 7 oracles, the first 7, there's going to be a typical pattern. The Lord is going to be speaking. He's going to identify sins or an extreme amount of sins, maybe identify a particular sin, a national sin or a sin of the leadership or a sin of the culture, and then announce some kind of punishment. And the punishment in most cases is going to be, it's going to include some kind of fire, fire in the strongholds or the fortified cities or in the palace or in the city. So here's, for example, the first one, to Damascus, which would be to Syria, to the north, or the Arameans. For 3 sins of Damascus, that's the capital, and many times the nation itself isn't mentioned, but the key cities are, or the capital is, or the place of the king is. For 3 sins of Damascus, even for 4, I will not turn back my wrath. And so one of the things that we see in this book is the definitive judgment of God that is coming. Sometimes there's a warning, sometimes God, you know, sends some kind of a plague or a drought or a famine to kind of, you know, warn the people, and there's repentance. This is like, it's over. Even the very fact in chapter 1, verse 2, the Lord roars from Zion, the thunders from Jerusalem, the pastures of the shepherds dry up, the top of Carmel weathers, there's nothing left. This is the end game. And so when he says, and he begins all of them by saying this, for 3 sins, even for 4, that's to say it this way, there are 3 sins that have filled up the extreme amount. You're done with 3 sins. Heck, there's even another one. There's even a bonus one. You've got more than enough. In other words, there's been 3 sins that result in judgment, but I've let it go long enough that you've even got an extra sin in there. And so this is even a sign of mercy or compassion. He's waited long enough. In other words, by the time you get to this 4th sin, we're not turning back. This is going to be judgment for sure. And now he goes on and says, because she, Damascus or Syria, the Arameans, threshed Gilead, which is a land east of the Dead Sea. It's a land that Israel occupied but was taken by the Arameans or the Syrians. She threshed Gilead with sledges having iron teeth. In other words, they not just captured the people, they just didn't take over the land. They drug them apparently into the ground, just grinding them out like they were like grain. I will send fire upon the house of Hazael. And then there's that fire of judgment. The house of Hazael is the name of one of the kings on the house of Hazael. And what will consume the and I will consume the fortress of Ben-Hadad. And those are two names of two kings. So there's Hazael the first, Hazael the second, Hazael the third, Ben-Hadad the first, Ben-Hadad the second. They went back and forth. And so Hazael's a royal name. Ben-Hadad is a royal name. And then I'll break down the gate of Damascus. I'll destroy the king who is in the valley of Avon. That's a lush valley where a lot of idol worship took place. We can find it on the map. And the one who holds the scepter in Beth Eden, that's again a province within Assyria. There's someone else, a little kingship there. The people of Aram will go into exile to Kir. Now, Kir, we're going to read through this book of Amos, and we're going to find out that they originally came from the land of Kir. Kir is on the other side of the Euphrates, and there was a migration of people over into Syria that became the Syrians or the Arameans. At this point right here, they're being told, you've gone too far. I'm sending you back to where you came from. And what is going to be interesting here with this being speaking to these six nations, we are not surprised, and the average Christian is not surprised. Most Christians are surprised if they even know there's an Old Testament. But, you know, surprised if God is talking to Israel and God is sending prophets to Judah. But what we're going to see here, and this ties right into the book of Jonah, and Jonah is probably dated to 759. That's a safe date for Jonah. He's going to go up while Assyria has declined, is having all kinds of trouble. Jonah's going to be taken out of Amos's culture and sent to Nineveh to prophesy and tell them. Now notice, Assyria is not mentioned in here. There's nothing about Nineveh in these verses. It's Syria, the furthest north. Then we go over to Phoenicia, come down into Philistia, go south to Edom, up to Moab and Ammon, and then to Judah and Israel. But as far as northern Assyria, nothing is said. Instead, Jonah is sent there and told. They are told, you've got 40 days, and then this whole place is coming down. And what did they do? They repented. And that was probably 759, because at that point, their culture begins to turn around. They regroup, and they begin a western march, and I'll show you on the time chart. And they end up coming down, and they're the ones that eventually destroy Israel. So you see Jonah going to not the Israelites, but leaving Israel and going up north to the Assyrians. These six nations are all pagan nations, but God is speaking to them, bringing judgment on them, sending a prophet to them, and announcing their sin, and the judgment is going to be expected. And what's interesting is, several things, is one, that he's demonstrating here that he has a relationship with all these nations. A lot of times we just get stuck in thinking, well, he's got a covenant with Israel and Judah, and the pagan nations are just in a free-for-all. God is always sovereign over all the nations, not just as the Lord, you know, that he's in charge of them all, but he's actually got some kind of interaction with them, not on the extent that Israel and Judah had. They had a specific covenant. They had a covenant that was revealed, written down in tablet form, in written documentation, with his presence in a temple. So Israel, or we should say the Israelites as a group, and now particularly Judah, they've got God's presence in the temple. The other nations did not have that, but they were not lost in the sense of they knew how to behave. And when they crossed the line and misbehaved, again, none of these are covenant violations. These are just basic sins against humanity. And when they commit this in an extreme form, God is going to bring judgment on them because they've, in a sense, violated his covenant with them. And the very fact that we're going to find out in this book, the Syrians or the Arameans came from Kir on the other side of the Euphrates, came and were brought over and settled in Syria, and now they've gone too far. God is saying, okay, I'm done. I'm taking you back to where you came from. Now, if you think about it, and you know this, what does that sound like? That sounds like God having an exodus. He took Israel out of Egypt, led them to the land he gave them, and there was always that threat. Listen, I'll send you back. I'll send you back where you came from. I'll send you back into Egypt. I'll let Egypt come up and oppress you. And the first thing that happens after Solomon rebels and Rehoboam becomes king, guess what? Shishak, god of Egypt, comes up, takes all their gold and takes back. God says, I'll send you right back to where you came from. And so it's interesting, his interaction with Syria and them being brought out of Kerr and being sent back to Kerr is exactly the same way he portrays or deals with Israel. And so you're going to see that throughout all of these. When we get through those, we'll go through those and we'll go through those verses again. His interaction with those six nations. If you jump over to chapter 2, verse 4, this is what the Lord says for the three sins of Judah. Now he's talking to his covenant nation, Judah. I will not turn back my wrath because they have rejected the law of the Lord. Now, that doesn't say they threshed people or they sold people into slavery. It says you've rejected the law of the Lord. I gave you my expectations and you ignored it and have not kept his decrees. Because they have been led astray by false gods, the gods of their ancestors followed, which means they've gone the way of the Canaanites, I will send fire, there's your fire of judgment, up on Judah that will consume the fortresses of Jerusalem. Your defenses will be consumed. And again, we'll talk about that as we go. And then beginning in verse 6, this is what the Lord says, for three sins of Israel, even for four, I'll not turn back my wrath. And now you've got a list. We got the first five are right there. You sold the righteous for silver. You denied justice. A father and son used the same girl. The garments are taken in pledge. And then in the house of their God, they drink wine taken as fines. And we'll explain all that when we get through there. But it doesn't stop there. It goes on into verse 9, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, it's all the way down to verse 16, where the other oracles are shorter. Israel's got an extended proclamation against them because this book is Amos addressing Israel in Israel, most likely in the southern temple area, the golden calf in Bethel. Also, Dan is mentioned, the northern place of the calf worship. And then Syria itself has also maybe got a temple for the golden calf. Now, when we talk about one of the problems they're going to have here, and there are several things I've got to say about this, is we're going to find out that these people are very religious. And I mentioned this last night in Revelation when we're going through chapters 8, 9, and 10. But these people are very religious. They have very stringent rituals that they're following. They're very obedient to go and pay the tithe and pay the tribute and celebrate the feast like they're supposed to. But they've got a combination, synchronism is what it's called, where they still are going to people of Israel, although we talk about the golden calf. There is the golden calf in Bethel and in Dan. But of course, they're going to take, it's just natural, they're going to take their previous experience from Yahweh worship and blend it into this worship here of the golden calf. Even the fact that Jeroboam the first, when he first introduced the golden calf in Bethel right after the days of Solomon when they rebelled against Solomon's son Rehoboam and they went north and built these two golden calf altars. One of the things he says, these are your gods, O Israel, that brought you out of Egypt. They take Yahweh worship and just change the gods a little bit and say, this is we're doing the same thing they're doing in Jerusalem. These are the gods of the golden calf. Remember Aaron making a golden calf image down on Mount Sinai. Remember the worship that's taking place in Egypt. It's easy to trace these golden calves back to the founding of Israel on Mount Sinai with Aaron, trace it back into Egypt. So there's going to be a combination of worship of the golden calf combined with Yahweh worship. They speak of the Lord. They know the Lord, but they've got a twisted, perverted understanding of the Lord. But they've also got Canaanite practices in there also. So they've got a combination of golden calf, Yahweh worship, and Canaanite worship that makes up their religion. And so they've definitely got temples, offerings, they've got a priesthood, they're very religious. Now what's unique, and this is important for you to understand, what's unique about these religions, it's going to be hard for you to understand this, and again, not like I'm going to drop some big bombshell on you, but it's hard for us because it's easy for us, and we all agree with this. You may have the talk, but do you have the walk? You can talk the Christian life, but can you walk the Christian life? We expect the Christian not just to know the doctrine, but to also walk the walk. You can't say, well, I went to theology school, but I don't do any of that stuff. I just have all the answers. We know that's not right. We want to see someone that knows the doctrine and also walks the walk because we've combined our faith with our lifestyle. We can't separate doctrine from morality. We can't separate the nature of God from what we're being conformed into his image. So it's easy for Christians to see your religion has to be affecting your walk, your lifestyle. Otherwise, you've got a worthless religion. Now, the prophets right here, and Amos is one of the first prophets, maybe the first prophet, to write down his messages. They were really the ones who took this, although it's always been there, to really call culture to the place of this is your religion. We need to see it in your lifestyle. He's attacking them, not because they're not keeping their rituals up in Israel, because they are, although it's mixed with idol worship. What they've got, their lifestyle, is completely, I'll just say, void. The people, and this is just like you cannot separate, you know, in your honest Christian opinion, you can't separate your Christian walk from your Christian doctrine. They've got to be the same. Now, again, you falter sometimes, but you know, they should have been the same. I believe this. I should have done it the right way. These people had no problem. They are fully able to worship and participate in the rituals, but it had zero. There was zero over here. There was no impact. They could go over here and be religious, pay their tributes and offer their sacrifices, pay their tithe, then come over here and completely oppress people, completely abuse people. They had no social justice. This, their religion, did not create social justice. It was a complete vacuum in that area. And so that's what you're going to see. You're going to see a lot of things in here, but that's, and you can, obviously you're going to blame the people, but their religion, they did not have people every Sunday morning telling them in church, your walk needs to match what you say you believe. If you believe in Christ, you should be walking as Christ. That's not what they're hearing in their religious rituals. So anyway, we talk about Israel then as we go on, going through this outline. The point 2C, I've got chapter 2, verse 6, going all the way up to chapter 6, verse 14, and you can see all those verses there. That is Amos continuing to address Israel for their sins. And some of the things you've got right here, chapter 2, verses 6 through 16, that would be the eighth of the opening oracles. Israel spoke to just like the other nations. Then chapter 3, verses 1 through 15, Israel and probably all of the tribes are rebuked, and then punishment is announced. Their sins are identified. Here's the punishment that's coming. Chapter 4, verse 1 through 3, we've got more. Israel's luxurious behavior is rebuked, and we're going to get, that's why the archaeology portion is very important, because it's clear archaeologically the vast difference between the wealthy and what was going on in their economic world at that time. They're extremely luxurious, and they're chastised for not returning to the Lord during the cycles of discipline. Chapter 5, verse 1 through 17, there's lamentation for fallen Israel, almost like a funeral song, like Jeremiah wrote the book of Lamentations after Jerusalem, as he watched the city burn and the dead bodies in the streets and people going off into captivity. He writes Lamentations. He's mourning a funeral procession for the city that he's watching burn. Well, chapter 5 is a lamentation by Amos, but it's a lamentation for the city and the land of Israel before it even happens. It's almost a prophetic lamentation. And then point 5 there under C5, 5:18 through 6:14, excuses for Israel's failure is discredited. Culture sins are identified and judgment of suffering is announced. In other words, God's going to go through and say, if this is your excuse, that doesn't make sense because, you know, and he's going to counter all of their lame excuses on why they are the way they are, and it's going to come down to being their fault. Then chapter 7 begins something a little different. There's going to be four visions. There's going to be three visions and then a narrative where he's going to have a conflict with Amaziah the priest at Bethel. And then a fourth vision is going to follow. They're short visions. The first vision is total destruction of Israel by locusts. But Amos is going to intercede, and the Lord is going to say, okay, I'll relent. In other words, he says, I'm going to destroy the land with locusts. And Amos is going to go, there's not going to be anything left. God says, okay, I won't do that. Then the next one, the vision, is judgment of fire, where everything is going to be consumed by fire. And Amos intercedes and says, but Lord, they're too small. They'll never make it. The Lord is going to relent. Then there's a vision of tin. Some say the plumb line. We'll get into that wording right there. But of tin, which sounds like the word moaning. It's going to be a judgment of moaning. And there is no intercession. In other words, that one is going to take place. And then there's the narrative where Amos is confronted by Amaziah the priest at Bethel, probably by the golden calf of temple, and is told to get out. The land can't hear any more of your words. You're destroying people's morale. And then he says, I've got to prophesy. We'll go through all that. We've read a little bit of that. And then there's a fourth vision of summer fruit, but it's a word play because summer fruit sounds like end, you know, in the Hebrew, and meaning the end is here. And so the third and fourth visions are final, and they will take place. The first two, God doesn't follow through on. He backs off and doesn't do them. And then by chapter 8, chapter 9, verse 15 to the end, there's a final group of oracles and prophecies, again, identifying the sin. Another vision of the Lord standing by the altar, commanding that the capitals of the posts, the pillars, be shaken all the way down until the threshold shakes. So he strikes the top of the pillars in the temple, and the pillars shake all the way down, and the ground shakes because of it. And again, it's interesting because this book is identified as being given 2 years before the earthquake. And there's several times in this book, including right there at the end, or in chapter 9, where shaking or an earthquake is prophesied, which may be why the book of Amos shot to the top of the charts very quickly, because he spent a couple years prophesying about the earth shaking. Then all of a sudden, there's that earthquake. We handed information out last time we were here. And that earthquake, just as they're trying to kick him out of land, stop prophesying, go home, all of a sudden, boom, there's this earthquake, and the whole place is shaken from up north all the way down through Israel, all the way down into Judah, going all the way down south into the Negev. So anyway, those are all things taking place. Now, there's several things on here. I do want to, since I'm rolling on this, I'm going to keep going through. These are things I want you to know, things I've picked up while I was studying. General notes, Assyria, deportation. Assyria, as we've mentioned, is in decline right now during these years. They're in decline. They're not gone, but they're having their own internal troubles. They've got a series of three weak, ineffective kings. They're being pressured from the north. A kingdom from the north is putting pressure on them. And they've got all kinds of issues, including there's a solar eclipse. Different things are taking place. So Assyria is not even mentioned in the book of Amos. Amos does not say, like Jeremiah says, it's coming from the north. He talks about the Babylonians. He even tells the people, you know, surrender to Nebuchadnezzar and you'll be fine, because he's the one God gave everything to. Just surrender. Of course, they called him a traitor. Amos doesn't mention the Assyrians. Deportation is threatened throughout this book, where he says you're going to be taken to another land. We just already saw it. The Arameans are going to be taken back to Kir. I mean, they're going to be loaded up and taken back. That was a practice of the Assyrians. They'd been doing it for 100 years before. Now they're in decline, but they have demonstrated their ability to uproot entire groups of people and scatter them in different places. Even on the Lachish inscription, in Sennacherib's palace that was in Nineveh after he destroyed Lachish, there's images of people that are leaving. Now there's people being impaled on posts. There's people being decapitated and the bodies piled up. There's people before the king on their hands and knees. There's a variety of things, but there's also people, there's images on this huge mural of like carts loaded with all kinds of household goods, women driving the cart with children on it, and then men carrying behind them, carrying boxes. And they're leaving the city. In other words, what the Assyrians would kill the leadership, they would kill the soldiers, they'd do enough executions around the city on posts, impaling, early form of crucifixion. So when you saw the army, and were they being successful, you can see my neighbors, they're burning on stakes out there. They've been screaming for 3 days, they're still on that post. It's like, yeah, they'd use that kind of execution, that kind of intimidation, but basically they'd just load people up and they'd leave. So people would take their household goods and be leaving and heading off to wherever the Assyrians took them. And then we're going to see this is where the Samaritans come from, you know, in the New Testament, when Jesus meets the Samaritan woman and the Samaritans won't have anything to do with the Jews. Because when the Israelites are deported out of Israel, the land is not left to waste. Assyria controls it. What do they move in? They move in people from other nations, and they're not always the same. They mix them together. So there's no way that they can. You talk about culture shock. You go to the grocery store, there's six different people speaking six different languages from six different, all have been conquered recently by the Assyrians and then brought here. And there's no rebellion. You just kind of cooperate and get along because you know Assyria's in charge. Those people that were settled in Israel in the north, they became known as the Samaritans. And that's why the Jews, when they came back from Babylonian captivity, the Jews went into captivity, Judah and Benjamin, and a few members of the different tribes. they came back with Ezra and Nehemiah. They were Jews. But to the north, the northern kingdom had been dispersed and had been replaced, repopulated with pagans. And whoever was up there, they were not Jews. And so the Jews would have, they were foreigners. They were half-breeds. They had nothing to do with them. So again, that's part of that New Testament story there, as you know. Okay, so I'm looking at point one with the Assyrians' deportation. The Mosaic Covenant, and I've got the verses written down there, Leviticus, Deuteronomy, Exodus, all promised. Moses was very clear. The Lord was very clear in giving the promise. I'm going to give you this land, but if you do not do it the right way, if you forsake my covenant, I will deport you to countries far away. There's always the promise, but I will ultimately bring you back. In fact, the book of Amos, I didn't get there. If you look at the very last point of the outline, 4C, chapter 9, verse 11 through 15, guess what it is? Typical prophet of Israel. The promise of restoration of David's fallen power and kingdom in the distant future. Not going to happen next week, not going to happen next month, not going to happen in your lifetime. But this is not over. I've got a covenant with David. You're all going to go into captivity. But at the right time, I'm going to regroup this nation, bring them back, and we'll do what I intended to do the first time. There's always going to be that promise. Now notice, throughout history, there's no promise to Syria or Philistia or the Phoenicians or Edom or Ammon and Moab. Once they're gone, they're gone. They do not have a covenant. That is exactly what that verse means in Romans, taken out of Malachi, where it says, Jacob I've loved, Esau I have hated. It has nothing to do with Calvinism or eternal security, although I believe in eternal security, I don't believe in Calvinism. It has nothing to do with Esau and Edom are going to burn in hell and Jacob is going to go to heaven. Now, he didn't choose Jacob for salvation and Esau to go to hell. He chose Jacob to have this covenant with that's going to be special, and Esau was just one of the Gentile nations. In other words, when Esau went into captivity, they're done. I don't love them. That's what the word love means. It means covenant. I do not have a covenant with Esau. He's gone. Jacob, I loved him. I'm going to send him into captivity, but guess what? I will go get him and bring him back because I have loved him. It doesn't mean I'm emotionally connected to him. It means I have entered into a brotherhood, a covenant of brotherhood, and when I discipline him, I will bring him back. Esau, when I discipline, I never made an agreement with him. I do not have a love covenant. When I discipline them, they're gone. It has nothing to do about eternal life. Now again, Calvinists will jump all over that and call you a fool, but get used to being called a fool because it's just going to get worse in other areas of your life. If you've read anything or heard anything, wait until after tonight. Okay, Assyria had just subjugated Damascus, and we'll look at that here in a moment. So Assyria had taken Damascus, and they were now subjects of the Assyrians, so Samaria was no longer a problem. The decline began in 810 of Assyria. It's going to continue until about 783. And there's the three weak kings. I'll show you those kings here in a minute. The next part, point two on the next back page. I've already said this, idolatry, religion, and worship. Amos mentions the three centers of golden calf worship. The first two, definitely Bethel and Dan. And likely there is something in Samaria. Idol worship is identified by Amos, but it has also become a perverted form of Yahweh worship, and I've kind of identified that for you already. There's no moral behavior connected to it. Nations, the covenants. Besides the Arameans coming from Kerr, look at point 3b, other exoduses. The Philistines are going to come from Caphtor, according to Amos 9:7 and Jeremiah 47:4. They're probably the sea people. And there's a whole conversation about that. And you can see murals from Egypt of the Egyptians battling the sea people. A group of people came from Caphtor, from the Greek world, early during the 1400s BC, 1200 BCs. And they came in and they had sea battles with Egypt. And apparently they didn't take Egypt, obviously, but they crashed or settled on the coast of Israel, or where the Philistines are located, the Gaza Strip today. And that the Philistines, twice are said, come from Caphtor, which is the land of the Greeks. Israel, during this time in the northern Israel, had reached their peak in material power. We'll talk about that. They'd conquered extensive territory, extending the borders as big as David had under Jeroboam II. Not because necessarily of great leadership of Jeroboam II, but because the Syrians had been overtaken by the Assyrians. the Assyrians themselves have gotten in trouble and had to withdraw. So there's no one putting pressure on Israel. So, of course, they control all the trade routes. There's no trade pressure from anybody, and they're just bringing in tremendous wealth. The breakdown in society could be this. It could be the difference between the urban life and the rural life. The rural life had to work, had to produce the food, the crop, the animals, where the urban life, they're the ones who had connections with the markets and the trade routes, and they were buying the crops, selling them to other countries and on the trade routes for a tremendous profit, paying the laborers minimal amount of money. So the people in the cities, apparently, were making tremendous, ungodly, gross amounts of money, where the people that were the poor were continuing to kind of keep a status quo. And as oppression set in, started being oppressed by the wealthy. The wealthy began to even, and you'll read about it in Amos, where they began to fine the poor. And when the poor couldn't pay the fine, they take even more from them, taking their own property. Pretty soon, anyone who wasn't the extremely wealthy were impoverished because of injustice, because of, you know, poor laws. And again, that's what God is going to be very upset about in the book of Amos, is he's given the land this time of prosperity where they're controlling all the trade routes, but the rich just take all of it, make profit, and even then oppress the point of just grinding the poor into nothing, not letting them even have their share of it. And so that's what's taking place, and you can see that archaeologically. And then I've got the dates of Amos's ministry written down. I want to go through some more of these sheets. If you don't mind, this is for my own entertainment pleasure. This sheet right here. Because again, for me, and I assume it's like this for you, for me, if someone just hands me a Bible in a church, you know, it's like, I don't know where things are. It's just a bunch of pages stuck together of some, you know, random, just disconnected thoughts. And there's, you know, we honor the Bible, but, you know, and you can tell in churches today, they honor the Bible. They've got one somewhere, but they can't teach from it because no one really, I don't know, it's just disconnected thoughts. I don't even know, is Amos, is that in the New or Old Testament? I don't know. You know, they don't know, the average person. But when you start doing something like this, you start plugging stuff in, and you start realizing it's not, again, there's always going to be a mystery to it because it's, some of these documents are 2,000, 3,000 years old. But when you start making any kind of an effort, it all comes together. So what we've got here on this chart, you can see I haven't got the Egyptian side filled out, but I've got Babylon, Syria, Assyria, Israel, Judah, and the prophets. The main thing concerned here is going across the bottom is the prophets when they ministered. And if you turn to the back page of there, that chart continues. Now, I haven't filled that part out yet because we're not to those prophets. But those are all prophets that we've either talked about or will be talking about. Amos, Jonas, Micah, and I'll try and go right in order. I've already taught through Isaiah several years ago. It's online. Hosea, Nahum, Zephaniah, Jeremiah. I've taught through Jeremiah. Habakkuk. And then you turn the page, there's Zephaniah and Jeremiah. Those guys are overlapping. Habakkuk, Obadiah, Daniel. Of course, we've covered Daniel. Ezekiel, I've taught verse by verse through Daniel. Zechariah, I've taught verse by verse through Zechariah. Haggai, Ezra, Malachi. And then Joel. Now, that Joel being the last book in that list on page 2, It's either the first book or the last book. That general idea. I mean, people put it in different places. In other words, Joel could be written before Amos, and then Amos be the second book written. The reason for that, and again, there's several reasons, and I've switched my decision even as I studied this. But Joel is quoted by, now watch this, Joel is quoted by Amos and Micah and Isaiah, Jeremiah, all these people are going to be referring to Joel or having parts of Joel, which means Joel was either written first and everybody's quoting parts of his book, or wait a minute, maybe all these other books were written and Joel is using references that all the other prophets use and they're showing up in his writing. So, you know, it's not that everybody's copying Joel, it's that Joel's last, so of course he's going to use all the references he's got. And so because of other things, I put Joel at the end. So, and obviously, all of these things are debatable, but I just want to point that out. That's definitely debatable where I put Joel. But now, when you pop up above that, you've got the kings of Israel and the kings of Judah right above that. And this might be something that would be nice to have handy every once in a while, especially just laying around when we go through this. But you can see Amos is in his own title. He's prophesying during the reigns of Uzziah in Judah and Jeroboam. And there you've got Jeroboam and Uzziah right above him. And you see the years that they were in office or in as kings. Now, coming before Uzziah is Amaziah. I would like to have you notice his name. Amaziah is going to be the father of Uzziah. And Amaziah is going to be the son of Joash. And that's right there in the kings of Judah. Going up there to Israel, you're going to see that Jeroboam, and you may know this, you may not, but there's going to be a king, Omri, who's going to have a son named Ahab, and he's going to have a couple sons after him, and there's going to be four generations of the Omri dynasty. And Ahab, of course, the one who's going to marry Jezebel, he's going to be the one. He's recorded in some of the Assyrian documents as fighting against the Assyrian kings, Ahab. Anyway, Jehu was a general for this line of kings on the other side of the Jordan fighting in Gilead against the Syrians in his tent with his other commanders around him. And Elisha sends a prophet to run over and anoint Jehu with oil as the next king of Israel, the northern 10 tribes. That prophet traditionally is Jonah. It doesn't say it in the book, but Jonah is active at this time. He's working with Elisha, and he's sent over. And again, it's not a slam dunk that it's Jonah, but that is Jewish tradition, and it fits the time period and the occupation, and that he was a young man that ran over and anointed Jehu. Jehu, if you notice on your chart now, is the first king on your list of kings of Israel. He then jumps in his chariot, leads an attack with his chariot, attacking, coming into Jezreel and into the land of Samaria, northern Israel, and he attacks Ahab's family line right here. In fact, Ahab's wife, Grandma Jezebel, is still alive, and she comes out the window of the palace and hollers, "Traitor, traitor." And he says, "Who's on the Lord's side? Throw her down." And the guards threw her down, out the window. And that's as Jehu comes marching in, and he overthrew the line of Omri, and he begins the four generations of the line of Jehu in Israel. Now notice, in Israel, it's always going to be the line of David. David's son, David's son, David's son, all the way through. Except for one time, when Jezebel's daughter marries Jehoshaphat's son, and she moves into the palace of David, and then in this battle, he gets killed, leaving Athaliah, Jezebel's daughter, as the queen of Judah on David's throne, who's half Phoenician and married to, dad is Ahab. So now you've got a foreign king of Omri's line from Israel who had married a Phoenician, and she's sitting on the throne of David. And the first thing she does is kills all of the grandbabies, because they're all descendants of David. And she's trying to wipe out the line of David, just like Herod did. And that's part of this whole story here. But anyway, notice Jehu. And then after Jehu's going to come, his son Jehoahaz, and then his grandson Jehoash, and then his great-grandson Jeroboam II. And Jeroboam II is going to be the son, grandson, the great grandson of Jehu, who destroyed the house of Omri. And that's going to be the four line. When Jeroboam II dies, that's the end of that dynasty. And another king, and then you're going to have a series of kings, Zechariah, Shalem, Mahanaim, Pekahiah, Pekah, sounds like something from Tyler plays with, some Pikachu stuff, Hoshea. And some of them rule like for like a month or a day or a year. I mean, they keep getting assassinated. Those are the last days of the kingdom right there. Hosea lasts for 10 years. And they're going to be dealing with the kings above them. First of all, going up to Syria, you're going to see early on Jehu, his dynasty, Jehu and his sons are going to have to deal with Syria. Ahab had a fight with them, and they're fighting for the land of Gilead. The land of Gilead, again, is here's the Sea of Galilee, Jordan River, Dead Sea. The land of Gilead is right over here. This, of course, is Israel. Here's Samaria, right? It's a very poor map. But there's the Jezreel Valley right here that leads. It's a flat plain. Nazareth is right here on a high hill looking down. The city of Jezreel is right here. And the king's route is here. The coastal route is here. And so if you control Gilead and the king's route, and you control the coastal plain route, and you control this valley right here, you've got the major interstate. You own Walmart. Okay, this is, everything is going through here. Anything coming from Saudi Arabia is getting taxed. It goes north. Anything going from north, going down to Egypt, is getting taxed as it goes through all these checkpoints and stations. This is a moneymaker right here. Now, this is Gilead over here. And that's the land. Now, Jehu, when he was anointed, was over here fighting the Syrians for this land. And so you can see there for a while there with the Syrians, you've got Hazael, Ben-Hadad. Elisha is going to be ministering to those people. They know of Elisha. But now what we're interested in right now, the last one is going to be Rezin. There's a bunch of kings that we have no record of. I got question marks there. But now notice Assyria. You're going to have, again, Adad, Nerari III, Shalmaneser IV, Arshur-Dan III, Arshur-Naari V, Tiglath-Pileser III, Shalmaneser V. Now you're into someone serious, Shalmaneser V. Sargon II is going to destroy Israel. Notice, he's there when Hosea, the last days of Hosea. And then Sennacherib is going to be his son, and he's going to take over and also gets credit for destroying Israel, and he's going to be the one who attacks Judah. He destroys Lachish. In fact, he just lays waste everything in Judah, Sennacherib, everything in Judah except Jerusalem. And if you're watching me on Facebook at all, I put a little video up of that right there. Don't get upset if you didn't watch it. But Sennacherib, for some reason, historically on archive, a documentation like inscriptions, historically in Greek history and in the Bible, destroyed all of Judah, came up to the walls of Jerusalem and was threatening Hezekiah, and then all of a sudden decided, I'm leaving, and went back to Nineveh and put a huge monument on his wall, like down, if this was his palace, inner palace walls, it is a huge palace, that wall would be all inscribed with carvings of the Battle of Lachish, his last battle before Jerusalem. This wall, and coming on, this is all the details of everything that took place, just surrounded himself with that battle. But it's like, if you're such a great king, why did you walk away from Jerusalem and leave Hezekiah, one last lonely king of Judah, why did you leave him there alone? Well, the Bible tells us, Herodotus says mice came in and chewed up all the fabric in their camp one night before the battle, and all the bowstrings were gone, and they just tuck-tailed and ran. Josephus says a plague broke out, maybe connected to the rats. If you remember, they're in a very near location, that the same place when the Ark of the Covenant was taken into the Philistine territory. Remember what happened to the Philistines? They handed the Ark from city to city, the five major cities, because wherever they got the Ark, well, guess what happened? Remember what happened? Tumors and rats broke out, or hemorrhoids and rats infested the city, and people began to die. They said, we're not afraid. They took it to the next city. Gath took it. Gaza took it. Ascalon got it. And every time they took it, and finally they did what? They built a little cart. They made five golden rats and put it in there with the ark, and five golden hemorrhoids and put it in there. And they just set it back to Israel. And it went back to Israel and stopped at Beth Shemesh, and that's where the people found it. The Ark of the Covenant had come back. Well, now what happens here when Sennacherib gets down there and he's threatening Jerusalem, Isaiah and Hezekiah, according to Scripture, Isaiah gave him a prophecy, there's not going to be an arrow be shot. Herodotus says the rats came in and chewed up all the bowstrings. Josephus says a plague broke out. But the Bible says the Lord sent out his angel and 185,000 soldiers died that night. And when Sennacherib got up the next day, all of his men were dead. He just goes back to Nineveh. And that's when he carves on his palace walls, nothing about Jerusalem. We just left him there. We just took Jerusalem, left him there. But let me tell you about Lachish. He has all the details of his Lachish battle. That was his last battle before he's going to take Jerusalem. But for some reason, he conquered all the way down to the western, from the west, all the way down the western coast, all the way through Judah, and had pushed Egypt back. And all he had left was Jerusalem. And he got to Jerusalem, threatened them. The next day, he went home. And it's like, no matter how you slice or dice it, why did you not just stay like one more week and take Jerusalem? Why did you let Hezekiah stay in the city? Well, anyway, those are the kings right there. Now, if you turn the page, There is in the British Museum in London, and this is where you want to tune up right here, because this caught me off guard. I was in London, and all of a sudden it's like, the British Museum. And it's like, Tony plans the trip. You know, and I just, it's like, I'm busy, busy, busy. We're going to London. Okay, we're going to go to London. I'm looking forward to it. Get on the plane. We get there. All of a sudden, someone on my Facebook page, I was walking. I went down Abbey Road. I'm on Abbey Road taking pictures on Abbey Road. One of my Facebook friends in ministry from somewhere, you know, I've never met him, but he's been to Israel. We talk on Facebook and email back and forth. He goes, oh, he says, yeah, he says, if you get a chance, make sure you go to the British Museum. That was my high point. British Museum. It's like, what am I thinking? I was just thinking Abbey Road, went to a couple pubs where you had, like, they found DNA, and where C.S. Lewis, who used to meet Tozer, and they'd have, you know, shared drinks and stuff. So I'm going around just kind of having a good time. Wherever they went, saw the London Bridge. All of a sudden, we're leaving London this morning. And it's like, I haven't even stopped at the British Museum. It's got everything you ever want to see at the British Museum. So it's like, Tony, we're going to have to take our luggage to the British Museum because we're checking out of the hotel. And so I says, just give me an hour. I've got a little chart. I'm just going to run around and snap pictures. So this was completely, I'm just very fortunate. I got what I got. Well, here's one of the things that is there. It's called the Taylor Prism. There's three of them that have been found. One is in Jerusalem. One is in the Oxford Museum. One of them is in the British Museum. It's also known as the Sennacherib Prism. It's six-sided. You can see it right there. It's got cuneiform writing. I've got a close-up of it right there. And it details all of his battles through this period of time, including, if you turn the page now, including this section where he talks about what he did to Hezekiah. And it, right here, I've got the square drawn on there on the next page four. And it, the reference is to Hezekiah. As for Hezekiah the Judite, himself like a caged bird, I shut up in Jerusalem, his royal city. As for Hezekiah, the terrifying splendor of my majesty overcame him, Jerusalem, his royal city. So those are all references to Sennacherib, the Assyrian king, coming down. That's not Bible. It's recorded in the Bible. That is him talking about King Hezekiah and how he had him trapped in Jerusalem like a bird. And then what'd you do? Well, then I just came home. I mean, there's no end to the story. It's like, you conquered everybody except Hezekiah. Yeah, but I had him like a bird. It's just like, you know, you try and make the best sound. You tell the story, you make yourself sound good. But the question always is, why didn't you take? Now, here, over here, on the other part of that picture, page four, I've got the entire translation taken out there so you can read everything that he talks about as he came down. That's Hezekiah's own words. Now, again, there, that's good there. Turn the page. What else we got? Oh, okay. Here, stay with me. Go to this page right here. It'd be the next page. It's the Black Obelisk of Shalmaneser III. Now, if we go back to, if you can, do this with me. Go back to page one. Now, you may find this. I find this completely just amazing. And then after I'm amazed that everybody that has ever walked into a church doesn't have this stamped in their memory as first to know information. If you look right here on Shalmaneser, Shalmaneser's name is not on that list. This is Shalmaneser III. You can see on the list on page one, the second Assyrian king, Shalmaneser IV. Shalmaneser I is in front of that very first king of Assyria. And on this monument, it's four-sided. It's got him, it's got records, and there's cuneiform writing. So you can see that second picture, for example. There's cuneiform writing. It looks like little wedges or little trumpets at different angles and different, you know, directions. Those are letters. And, you know, with the translating of the Rosetta Stone, they could read that, and or they can read that. And it tells basically who they're taking captive, what they got from each country, and who the king was, and how many people came in as slaves. Those are all the details of how great Shalmaneser's battle successes were. Now, identified on that stone, if you see the second picture on, I don't know what page it is, just that very first page of the stone, you can see that top image under the writing, there's a guy on his hands and knees. Do you see that little guy on his hands and knees right here? Now, if you can't see it, just turn the page, and there's two more pictures of it. And there you've got your first picture on page six. I've got just that block right there. That's Shalmaneser standing. And then there's a guy on his hands and knees. And up above it identifies him as Jehu from the house of Omri. Now, again, that's genetically inaccurate because, remember, Omri was the one who overthrew the present king, the line of Jeroboam the first, and all those kings that came before him. He had a son named Ahab who married Jezebel, and he had a son named Amaziah and Jehoahaz or whatever. He had four kings right here, and then Jehu overthrew this dynasty and took over as king of Israel. So in the Assyrian Shalmaneser's mind, Jehu is from the line of Omri. He's from the house of Omri. Basically, he's the new king over Omri's house of Israel. And that's what it says on that. And then it tells you what he brought him in tribute. So what you have right there on his hands and knees, paying tribute to Shalmaneser, the Assyrian king, and kissing the ground, is that first king of Israel on that first page that I showed you, is Jehu, the great grandfather of Jeroboam the second. You've got Jehu, you've got the second king, the third king, then Jeroboam the second, who's the king of Amos's book. That's his great grandfather, on his hands and knees, kissing the dirt in front of Shalmaneser, paying him tribute. Do you know why? Because Jehu is asking for help against the Assyrians. Against the Syrians. So what has taken place right here? Again, on your map, here's Galilee, Jordan River. Here's Israel, the northern kingdom where Jehu's from. Here's Syria, or the Arameans. And up here is the Assyrians. I never abbreviate the word Assyrians. So what you've got is he's having trouble with the Syrians here and coming down here into Gilead. So Jehu goes up here to the Assyrians, the Shalmaneser, gives him money, tribute, honors him, and says, "Will you put some pressure on the Syrians for me?" And sure enough, the Assyrians come down and put pressure. That defeats the Syrians and pulls them up here, giving his great-grandson opportunity now to expand like he is. So this all is tying in together, and those are some pictures. And that obelisk, that black obelisk, is also at the British Museum. You walk right in, you can see all four. You can't believe you're standing right. You've seen it in books before. You've seen pictures of it somewhere. And so I couldn't believe all these things. There's other things there that I could show you. Now, Assyrian kings, this page very quickly. Page one, you can see right there at the very top, the fourth one down, Shalmaneser the third. That's the one we're talking about. Then you've got the three black ones, the four bold black ones. Those are the weak kings. That's the kings during the days of Amos. Then Tiglath-Pileser, Shalmaneser, and Sargon II. And just because I just got back, do me a favor, turn the page. And all of these kings, or a good portion of these kings, and I've got them listed here again, their palaces were discovered when the archaeologists went over there in the late 1800s and began to excavate. They found their palaces and huge inscriptions by them, all the details. Israel pops up being named. Ahab is mentioned, Jehu is mentioned, Hezekiah is mentioned, Omri is mentioned, battles that they fought in, Bible stories are mentioned. Anyway, here's the kings right here. There's the first one that I've got on page two, me standing by his little, you can see how big they are. And that's me with a selfie with Ashurnashipal the second from 885-860. So that is the Assyrian king. Remember, Amos begins around possibly right between 762 and 745, this Assyrian king is going to be about 100 years before. Then after him comes Shalmaneser the second, and then there's Jehu, and there's a picture, there's what I showed you before, and then there's another monument of his. Turn the page, page three, there's again Shamshi Aided from 824 to 811, and then there's an image of a god from Adai-Nirari's temple or palace. There's some names of some kings. And that leads us right up to the days, right there. And then at the bottom of page three is the days of Amos. And then you turn the page, and there's a picture of Sargon II, who was the father of Sennacherib. Sargon II is going to be the one who fulfills Amos's prophecies. He's going to be the one who takes Israel and destroys the land. He dies suddenly. Now, I'll tell you this, and I'll quit. Sargon II dies suddenly in 705. After having expanded the empire, and whenever something like that happens, in their worldview, the gods were very important, and you knew who the gods were favoring because who had the money, who won the battle, who had the favor. And if things started going bad, you knew right away the gods are mad at me. So my God, I did something that upset my God. And so they'll try. And when you die and your son gets the throne, it's a good indication this family may be out of favor with the gods. So Sennacherib was under tremendous pressure in 705, and he arrives in Jerusalem in 701. And in 705, he begins this. First of all, because his father died and he knows the gods are mad, he moves the capital to Nineveh, builds himself a brand new palace, a new start, pleases the new gods, goes to the east and southeast and kind of heads off the rising Babylonians, and then heads west on a conquering campaign, going down through Syria, down through Phoenicia, down through Philistia, just destroying. Many of the cities just surrender. But again, impaling people. They didn't surrender. They had attacked, tear their walls down, impale their leaders, cut off their hands. They had skinned people alive. They'd have piles of heads, put them on posts, just terrorize people, then deport the people, and just kept coming down. What he's doing is, it's propaganda. He's showing, gods have favored me, and I'm going to lay waste your city. And in other words, if you don't favor me like the gods, then I'm going to stack your heads up over here. And they just all just slaughter, went all the way through. That's Sargon and Sennacherib together. And then at the bottom of page 4, there's Sennacherib in a chariot. And then there's Sennacherib on his throne. And that's an image of that Lachish battle I was talking about that goes down a wall here, comes across here. That's a close-up of, right there, you can see to the left of that little picture, a couple guys on their hands and knees, a couple guys bowing down. You've got some leaders coming up to pay tribute to him. You've got someone in the back with some fans, fanning him, making sure the flies don't bother him. And then right behind the fanners, you've got his royal tent. And he's sitting on a little mound watching the Battle of Lachish. And that was, again, his last battle before 185,000 men of his died, and he went back to Nineveh and had this palace built for himself. So that kind of gives you a little bit of background there for the time of Amos. And I wanted to go, and I will probably next week, I wanted to go to 2 Kings chapter 14. You saw that there all night. And that's right during the days of when Amos is just coming into prophesying, when the king of Israel and the king of Judah have a confrontation, and they go to war against each other, and there's some fallout from that. I thought it'd be fun to read the kings that are mentioned in Amos actually interacting with each other, having a little battle, before Amos pecks up from his business, his sheep breeding business, his tree care business, whatever he's got, and he goes up across the border into Israel and starts prophesying at Bethel against their nation, talking about things, telling you, now he's not talking to a nation that's crumbling. He's talking to a nation that is at the peak of their power. They've expanded all the way up north into Syria. Syria's not a problem. The Assyrians are not a problem. They control the trade routes. Everybody's prospering. In fact, it's ridiculous how much money there is. And he's in there saying bad things to them. And I'll say this and I'm done. If he starts in 762... Sargon II, it was 722 when Samaria falls and is gone. So you've got exactly 40 years from the beginning of Amos' ministry until they are in crazy, crazy, crazy money here. And here, they're all gone. Within 40 years, they're gone. Assyria was nothing. And 40 years later, Assyria was everything and marching into Judah. So, and it's interesting. So that's where Amos comes in. I'll quit and I'll pray and you're free to go. Thank you for being here. Father, we do thank you again for your truth. We thank you for the record we have both in the Bible and in history. We ask that we may take heed, that we'd be able to hear the words that you spoke through Amos, and that we'd be able to make application in our own lives. We do thank you for this and ask that our faith would grow and have more confidence in you, even in our own day, as history has not changed. It just continues under your leadership and guidance. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your time.